This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And yes, indeed, this is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector. And as we do every Friday morning, we have a guest from the arts or from politics or international relations, economics, business, the NGO sector, the media, and we like to tackle topics, ideas, and activities in a wider, more discursive kind of way so that it's not a straightforward interview. It's, you get inside the thoughts and the mind of the guest, and I hope that today's guest, Brett Bailey, will be just exactly one of those people. Brett's work is well known in this country, but it's perhaps even better known in avant-garde art circles and festivals and institutions pretty much around the world now. Some of his work has traveled extensively or has been commissioned or done specifically for art festivals in Europe and other places. And it really is a pleasure to have Brett this morning. His company, the banner under which he does this work, is Third World Bun Fight, which I guess gives you something of the flavor of what he's doing. If you read his website or the bios that are published about him, it says something like, his iconoclastic theatrical works interrogate the dynamics of the post-colonial world. Now, I don't actually know what that meant, but I'm sure Brett can explain it to me in better terms. Brett studied at the University of Cape Town, then did further work in Amsterdam. And over the years, I've seen a number of his works. I recall with some pleasure or fear, E Mumbo Jumbo, retelling of the opera Macbeth. You did a work for the opening of the World Summit on Arts and Culture. I believe it was called 2008 or 2009, which had as its text, I think, migration and the travails of people who migrate and the difficulties. And you gave us a lot, and you worked with some interesting people to create that. Then there was a work at the then called Grahamstown National Arts Festival. You made us go to an unused train station. And then we had to follow a silent guide to various way stations in the dark, in the mist, in the cold. And it was eerie and interesting. And I kept waiting to trip over a rock. But I felt very differently about what I was seeing than I thought I would when I got there. And I guess my first question, now I should also mention that one of his newer incarnations, he's now at Spear Vineyard Entertainment Center guest facility in near Cape Town, where he is, I guess, the performance and artistic director. Is that how we call it now?
Performing arts programmer, director, yeah, probably something like that, yeah.
You don't worry about the title so much. You worry about what you get done.
I hate titles. I hate being called Mr. Bailey. I hate titles. Speak to me of, I find them very alienating things. Yeah, I don't go with titles much.
He's made his mark in many, many places. And now you have a new work, which is on it at Spear, I believe, or will be momentarily, Constellations. And you'll have to tell us what that is about, because obviously we haven't seen it yet. First question for you, because you have so many different kinds of things that you've put together for stage, where do your inspirations, where do your ideas come from? What's the raw material that you like to draw on?
Hi, Brooks, and thanks for having me here. It's great to be on this platform. You know, it's a tricky thing for me to find a kernel or a little nucleus around which to gather my material and my energy. It always takes me a long time, and there's no easy way, actually. Like I'll do a lot of research and I'll find things, and there's a sense that this might be the one, but then it doesn't hook me. I think it has to resonate with me really deeply on some level. Mythology does that. You know, when I was in my early days of being an artist, I started reading Jung, Carl Gustav Jung, and certainly his orientation or the people that cluster around him have been very inspirational on me. Joseph Campbell, Maria van France, et cetera, et cetera. And I was looking for a story from the Bible. That was the last production I did was called Samson. And I was fascinated with how the Greeks had mined their sacred texts to make their great dramas. And I thought, let me look to the Bible, although I'm not really religious in that sense. I thought this is really the text that has shaped our civilization. And so let me look to it. And I read so many different stories, and the story of Samson, just, I couldn't tell why it resonated. It sparked something inside me that just smoldered there. And I found some other interesting stories, but it just kept coming back to Samson, and I had no idea what it meant. And it took me a really long time to find out what it meant. What did Samson mean? That takes a lot of research, and it takes a lot of dreaming, and it's picture research and reading research and tapping into what's happening in the world at the moment, the crises we're living through. And slowly stuff starts to build up around it. And that, so I have no real idea when I'm setting out to make something, I'm going to make a work about this. It's more like there is something, there's a little grain of sand. It's rather like a pearl building up around it. Something forms around it. And that's how works shape up for me. That's where my material comes from.
Yeah. No, I mean, I can see where Samson would work. Samson's been the inspiration for numerous pieces of art. There's a wonderful opera that evolved out of the Samson story. With some of the 19th century arias, one of which, now since you mentioned it, now of course I have an earworm playing away with some of the music. And if you had been doing it this week, you could easily have sort of vaulted right into the front page. Which wasn't obviously your plan, but it's never quite gone away. Constellations, this new piece, I can't find a lot about it yet. What is it exactly?
Look, it's actually not a new piece. It's in its fourth iteration. Basically I've been running the performing arts program with Spear for 3 years now. This started 4 years ago, and it was the first year of COVID, and I was aware how many artists had no work, performing artists. Gigs had been canceled. You know the scenario. We don't have to unpack COVID. And there was also the frustration of people being kept up in their apartments, not being able to get out into nature, not being able to attend performances, not having that thrill of being in groups experiencing culture together. And so I came up with a project that satisfied a lot of these little nubs, and that was to create a series of routes. We had three routes. Each of them had four campfires on it, and the audience would come together. They were divided into small groups traveling on one of the routes, and they would visit four campfires in a night on one of the routes. And at those campfires, you might find a musician, a performing artist, a philosopher, an historian, a shaman, who would then hold space for 30 minutes. And so you had no idea who you were going to meet and what was going to happen. All you knew that you were outside with no technology, paraffin lanterns and campfires moving from little fireside gathering to fireside gathering. And so that is really how the concept still is, although it has evolved. You know, I sort of got tired of that format, so it's changed a bit for this year, but that is basically the format. Small groups of people being led into the wilderness and spending sojourns around the fire with artists.
Well, I mean, that goes back to the earliest business with the arts, really. 50,000, 100,000 years ago, gathering around a campfire after dinner, somebody says, long ago.
Exactly. I've got a story to tell.
When our ancestors were X, Y, and Z.
And
then you look up at the sky, and then someone says, you see those stars, those were
the
our
constellation. The constellation. There you go. Yeah.
It's the whole, there is, I can write the foreword for you now.
You know, in that moment, it was so special, as I said, when people were so, you know, the energy was so tight. It's easy to forget what things were like 3 years ago, but you know, we were so wrapped up behind masks and afraid. You know, people sit on tree stumps at constellations around a fire. We had to make sure that there was a particular, I can't remember, it was like a meter between each tree stump. A really crazy time. Now we can be a lot more intimate, obviously.
I know this phenomenon pretty directly. My daughter's a musician in Cape Town, and she was struggling with the same set of questions and, you know, doing a performance from your home to the universe and have no idea whether anybody or who is listening or enjoying or not. And, I mean, she knows people who were at by that point were sleeping in their cars because, you know, they'd run out of work completely. You're going to bring constellations up north. Maybe.
I think this conversation will very much lead us to what the funding for the arts is like in South Africa. And that's a pretty bleak story. You know, I mean, we pay our artists nicely and, the event costs about 400,000 rand to put the event together for 3 weekends. So, you know, it's always about where's the money coming from? That's the situation right now, as we know.
We're going to get to that particular question in just a minute.
I'm sure we'll take a short
time. There's no avoiding it, unfortunately. This is the Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we're speaking with the inimitable Brett Bailey. We'll be right back.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is the Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and today's guest for you is Brett Bailey, artist, creator, man of many talents, now with the work at Sphere in the Cape Town area, Constellations, a collection, small gatherings where you go in the dark to a campfire or a lantern lit space and you hear a musician or a storyteller or a shaman. Do you have comedians in this too?
No, I was never the kind of guy that laughed at jokes. And unfortunately, when I was at school, my friends used to watch the Goons. I don't even remember. I could never get it. I never got Trevor Noah. So comedians have never been my thing. I never got them. So they're no comedians. In fact, this year we got a theme this year, which is the Garden of Good and Evil. And so it's slightly different this year in that I have given each of the eight performers a character, and I wrote a little rhyme for them, and they have to then respond to that. So I'll read you one of the little rhymes, and this is a performer called Megan Choritz was given this. She's an actor, and the rhyme that she was given is, Charlotte keeps her husband Bob in a jar upon the shelf. Each night she reads him stories that she's written down herself. She's sure they'll make him happy. She kids herself she cares, though he hasn't made a comment since she pushed him down the stairs. So, and it's like these sinister little rhymes that are given to everybody, and the musicians interpret them the way they want to. Each one has their own character. And so they're a little bit Twin Peaksy, a little bit gothic, a little bit noir. It's a little bit of a...
Yeah, riddle if you're kicking the ashes down the steps. Sorry, you didn't laugh at my jokes. You're nothing but fertilizer. Goodbye. Now you alluded to the question when I asked you if you were going to take this work to Johannesburg, where I suspect there would be an audience for the macabre, given our circumstances here. You alluded to the question of funding, and this is always the question that arises, whether you're a single solitary performer or whether you're an orchestra of 100 performers. Money is the key. I imagine you have some fairly strong feelings about the way in which the arts get funded in this country these days.
Well, I think like so much in South Africa, so much is collapsing, you know, and I think that's one of the things that has collapsed. You know, I was on the artistic committee of the National Arts Festival for 4 years, ending in 2019. And I was just aware that we were running the main program of that festival on just over R1 million, you know, and that was the main program of the festival. You know, it's just extraordinary that we had to pull rabbits out of hats, but also how we were putting artists in the positions of finding rabbits to pull out of the threadbare hats they had. It is so difficult. I don't think we're unique in South Africa. You know, I mean, my next work is actually, maybe we'll get to this later, is an adaptation of Verdi's Otello. And part of the research I did was obviously looking at previous incarnations of Otello. And I mean, Laurence Olivier in the 60s was trying to raise funding for his movie of Otello, which he starred in eventually. But he found it so difficult to raise the money. And he had to end up making a very compromised version of this Shakespearean piece, because even Sir Laurence Olivier couldn't raise the money. So, you know, it's not a new story. My weakness is that I'm not a commercial artist. I don't really know how to be a commercial artist. It's not in my blood. So, you know, if I were making the kind of things that go on at Caesar's Palace or wherever else, Monte Cassino, wherever they go, I might be having an easier ride. But because I deal with difficult subject matter and I go very deep and I'm more interested in paradox than easy answers. My work is not easy and it's difficult to, you know, you fill out an National Arts Council funding and you have to tick boxes for how many disabled people are in the cast, how many minority groups are in the cast, how are you pandering to this group and that group and that group? And it's like the restrictions are so tight that it's, how does one express one's creative freedom and put a compelling funding proposal together? It's very hard. It's very hard.
You mentioned Othello, and although I like the play, the opera is in some ways more to my taste. And the story goes that the composer, Giuseppe Verdi, was being interviewed, and someone said to him, "Maestro Verdi, what is your theory of opera?" And Verdi looked at him, laser beams coming out of his eyes, I guess, in the late 19th century. It's my theory of opera. The seats should be filled.
Verdi was in the plum seats, man. He had it. He had Italy at his feet.
But curiously, he became a government official. You know, he ended up being a senator in the Italian parliament, and he was a strong advocate for, arts funding, which I guess there is a legacy that comes from that as well. This country doesn't really, I've never quite figured out why this country, unlike a number of other places, doesn't allow for gifts to the arts and culture to be tax deductible. That makes it a lot easier for a large company or an individual to give money to something because they think it has artistic or cultural merit and get something of a tax rebate or a break on their income taxes.
Sure.
And yet you don't get that here.
No. I mean, look, there are some great initiatives like, BASA, Business Arts South Africa, mm-hmm. who's certainly trying to facilitate the partnerships between artists and, or the arts and, but yeah, it's, there's also not the great thing, which you probably know about in the phenomenon in, the United States of, philanthropists who are really, you know, bequesting large amounts of money to the arts just to, I mean, that's so much of the independent arts scene in the United States is run by philanthropists, and we don't have that here to the same extent.
Well, because there's a whole system of tax benefits that accrue in the process.
There you go. Exactly. Yeah.
And if you give money to a giving foundation, you get a break, and the giving foundation now has money to give to performers or institutions.
So it's incentivized. Exactly.
And there are some cities where over the years there's been enormous competition, as in New York, between who is going to be the most generous of benefactors to museums, arts, cultural centers, avant-garde groups. We're going to take another quick break, and we will be back with our conversation with Brett Bailey. This is Brooke Spector, and this is The Deep Dive, and we'll be right back.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And this is The Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, and we're talking with Brett Bailey, man who creates work that isn't for everybody, but is extraordinary when you see it, or you sit around the campfire listening to parts of it, or you sit in an audience where he has recreated the famous Géricault picture of people falling off a collapsing ship that's sinking as part of the introduction and opening evening for International Cultural Conference. I remember sitting there watching this. I know this picture.
Géricault, the Rock of the Medusa.
Absolutely. When you do your work, you obviously, not that it influences you in a direct and specific way, but who are the artists or creatives or performers? Who are the people that inspire you, that you say, I like that. I get that. I appreciate that.
Let's see. In theater, not so many, actually. I'm not such a theater lover. You know, this is one of the quirks that I've always been criticized for, have the eyebrows raised at me, because I find it very difficult to suspend my disbelief in a theater. So I take much more inspiration from films and from visual arts and from music, and possibly from literature as well, but very little from theater. Tarkovsky's films do a lot for me. David Lynch's films do a lot for me. I'm not very good at remembering directors' names. There's a lot of Iranian directors and Turkish directors whose work I really love. I'm not much of a Hollywood animal. I can't bear Netflix because it's very much the American model. But I prefer films from the Far East, from the Middle East, from Europe. I listen to a lot of ambient electronic music. My favorite author, I would say, is Cormac McCarthy. Very, very dark. Chuckle there.
I just went, huh? I can see the darkness part easily.
I think that's who I look to more than theater. I struggle with theater.
When you say East Asian film, people like Kurosawa.
Exactly. Or... Yeah. And many, you know, there's a great channel that I subscribe to, a streaming channel called Mubi, MUBI.com, which is a lot of classic films that not mainstream films, but then also from people that you just wouldn't find other than on marginal film festivals, and that those are a lot of Eastern directors and Iranian, Middle Eastern, etc. And I'm not very good at remembering their names, but really some extraordinary people there with very beautiful visions that haven't been co-opted by the great big machines that run Hollywood.
I mean, I fell in love with Kurosawa films a long time ago, and got to see the premiere, the actual premiere of the film Ron when it first.
Ah, well, you're lucky. Where was that?
The premiere was in Sapporo, Japan, because they used that city's orchestra for the soundtrack, so they got the first cut at it. Mm. And I remember hearing Japanese film critics talk about Kurosawa, who Westerners think of as the avatar of Japanese filmmaking. They said, sure. Oh, I don't know, too Western.
Oh, really? Isn't that interesting, huh?
I mean, where you would have thought they would have just embraced him and said, yes, he's our greatest filmmaker. No, he's far too Western.
I think he lives in that sort of international terrain, doesn't he? Where there's a group of artists who sort of live in that terrain, which touches on so many different countries. They can relate, people from so many different countries can relate to them.
Well, I think they were also a little bit unhappy with the idea that he was such a finicky perfectionist that he would make a castle being under siege and a battle, redo it several times because the lighting, the natural lighting from the sun came through the clouds the wrong way.
Like Kubrick or like the theater maker Robert Wilson. He's a bit like that as well. Yeah.
I mean, just we're going to do it and do it again until the sunlight works out. You can only imagine being the poor tired horses by that point.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I'm trying to do the wrong thing, which is to peg you to a category. And I know that's not fair. But almost inevitably we end up saying that you are an avant-garde creator in some way. I mean, you took a classic work, Macbeth, you're going to take Othello. These are not out there on the far edges of things. They've been interpreted and reinterpreted hundreds of times. And yet you're trying to put a unique Brett Bailey-esque approach to this work.
I wouldn't say I'm trying to do that, Brooks. Othello was really a difficult one because we had a real successful run with Macbeth. I'm working with a Belgian composer. And a Serbian conductor, and we made the Macbeth together, and we're doing the Othello together, and it was okay. Let's find another opera, and I looked at a lot of operas, and I found it very difficult because a lot of the, particularly the 19th century operas, are very plots are really a bit silly, and the 18th century ones as well. And so I moved in on Othello, but it took me a long time because it's quite an unlikable story. You know, it's just this raw evil, of Iago and the fact that Iago gets away at the end in the Shakespeare, he doesn't get away at the end, but in the Verdi, he escapes. And so it's had to take me to very dark places. And again, it's like, it's not about putting the Brett Bailey spin on it. It's trying to find what is the kernel of the work and what clusters around it. And for me, it's a work that speaks the way I understand it now. It speaks very much to our time where everything that is so beautiful, precious, fragile, things that talk about reconciliation. This is all for me epitomized in the relationship between Othello and Desdemona. And that something comes in, a man who is completely driven by his self-interest, by his greed, by his desire for power, by his use of disinformation, can come and for some nihilistic, find some nihilistic sadistic pleasure in destroying that at any ends, at whatever the cost. And for, that is what the work becomes about for me. The place I the kind of set it now has got something to do, it's somewhere in the global south. It's not particular, on the front lines of the climate crisis where rivers are drying up, jungles are burning out. So it's a small community trying to deal with this situation and a man that comes in to destabilize the whole thing. And so is that putting a Brett Bailey on it? I don't know. It's just trying to find how does that story make sense to me in this moment?
Well, yeah. I mean, critics have always puzzled over what exactly is Iago on about anyway. I mean, it's not like he's been cheated. It's not like his son has been eclipsed by his superior officer. He's being treated well enough. There's no anything on him except he's angry about something.
Well, the possible that he was passed over. Cassio was promoted above him. And there's also some possibility that Othello might have been messing around with his wife, but it's very subliminal really. And exactly. I mean, he's this malevolent force of Cormac McCarthy's book Blood Meridian really helped me there. There's this character, the Judge Holden, who leads this band of booty hunters who go killing Native Americans and Mexicans to bring back their scalps. And you cannot find any motivation in this character, Judge Holden, but somehow he resonates with Iago. There's just something, there's something malicious. There's some, it's like an archetypal principle of destruction for the sake of destruction. It's extraordinary, but fascinating.
You should consider Rigoletto.
Again, it's a comedy. You see, there we go. It's got a happy ending and it's light. I'm not so. It's got some beautiful moments in it, of course. The Rigoletto. The
Rigoletto. People die.
Yeah.
His own daughter. I mean, that's not exactly funny.
No, I will consider. I'm sure I'll consider Rigoletto eventually.
Yeah, I mean, I've always liked it because the Duke or the Count or whatever he is of Mantua, he's another one of these characters who's just mean. Yeah. His motives are a little bit obscure, actually, other than just personal enjoyment. Let me ask you this, to sort of step back a little bit and look at the artistic landscape as a whole in this country. Who are the other South African artists, creative people, theater, film, dance, whatever? I know you've worked with Gregory Makoma in the past as well, but who are the
I admire him immensely.
Who've inspired you or you admire? Who are the others?
I mean, if I go back to inspiration, you know, I don't know if you knew Mavis Taylor. I mean, she was a teacher for mine a short time when I was at university. And then I spent a year in India in 1994 and I came back and I ended up living with her for a year and a half. And, she was running a project called the New Africa Theatre Project, which was really looking at young black performers. And it was really driven by her sense of a need for transformation in this country through the arts and through drama. And I think she really put me in a direction. I think she was probably one of the most influential people there was, for me. And I think she fulfilled she was in a similar role to what Barney Simon was in Johannesburg. She's been very influential. Other people I admire, I admire Sylvain Strike. I admire Laura Foote. I admire Magnet Theatre Company in Cape Town. You know, it's the funny thing with theatre is, and it's different to the visual arts, and that's really about how it's about the economy, I think, is how little of work from other provinces we end up seeing. You know, I'm not really so aware of what's going on in Johannesburg anymore. I know of William Kentridge's extraordinary project, but apart from that, I don't really know what's going on in Johannesburg at all anymore. And Durban, not at all.
Yeah, I mean, there used to be more transferring of work
from the major cities
one to the next. There was almost an informal, but it was a fairly routine circuit of works and people that would move from place to place. And that again, funding has become a question. And so that has, significantly decreased. You mentioned Mavis Taylor. I mean, she's a figure, I think, who has been unfairly not forgotten, but sort of almost overlooked at this point, except perhaps for the people who were directly influenced by her, such as yourself.
Yeah.
And it's a shame. There's no, there's not much fuss being made about the contribution that she did make.
How, what was your connection with her? How did your path overlap with hers?
Well, I happened to, I got to meet her in the 1980s when I was still with the embassy, and I routinely went to Cape Town, and Johannesburg and Durban to try to find out what was new and what was happening. And some of the people that I knew had studied under her or with her at some point as well. And they all said, you got to go talk to Mavis Taylor.
Sure.
And so we did. And we spent a day together at one point. She was explaining how you get raw talent somehow and push it through so that it becomes better skilled, better practiced, and ultimately professionalized. If that's a word, I'm not sure.
Well, I think, and it's interesting you say that, because I think that's, I wasn't aware that I'd picked that up from her, but probably I did, which, you know, I very seldom work with performers that come from the academies. I tend to work from, with people that don't come from that. And maybe I picked that up from her. It's funny, this thing of professional, you know, often in, when we tour in Europe, people ask me, is your company professional? Are your actors professionals or not? And I'm like, I don't know if that makes much sense in the context that I come from in South Africa. I think it's a different world here. What does it mean?
And I picked up in one of the things that you're writing, that's been written about you, we'll talk about it after we take this next break. Shane Cooper and your appreciation for traditional aspects of Xhosa culture. But we'll take a station break now, and we'll come right back. This is Brooke Spector with The Deep Dive, and our guest today is creative genius Brett Bailey.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive, and I'm Brooke Spector, and our guest today is Brett Bailey. Those of you who get to Cape Town in the next week or two, or are already in Cape Town, you could go see his current work, Constellations, at Spear. And you've had a chance to see his work in many different places and many different times. Shane Cooper, musician, working with him.
We worked with, he was my musical director and my composer for Samson. So it was, you know, I was interested in making a ritualistic work about Samson. For me, Samson became somebody who channeled the avatar. He was almost like an avatar for the suppressed rage of colonialism, imperialism, and this rage breaks out at some point with devastating consequences. And so, and because I've worked, I cut my teeth in my early days in the 90s, spending a lot of time working with Sangomas, in the Transkei. I spent several months living there, with Sangomas and, you know, fostering my fascination with ritual, and also my own paternal grandmother was a spirit medium. And so this has always been part of my consciousness, you know, this thing of this sense of moving between realms, I suppose. And so for me, Samson became this spiritual, I mean, this ritualistic drama, and Shane really, he helped me bring that vision alive. And he's an extraordinary musician, and yeah, it's really something extraordinary.
And of course you had an association with, one of my favorite creative people out there, Gregory Matoma.
A brief association. That was the World Summit on Arts and Culture. I think it might have been 2010. Was it, you said 29. It might have been 2009.
I'm trying to remember. It's been a few weeks.
Yeah. I feel it was 2010, but then, you know, it was because the World Cup. No, it wasn't. It doesn't matter. It was around then. And yeah, he choreographed that piece for me. And what a pleasure. I mean, I worked with him also. He was on the National Arts Festival Artistic Committee with me for several years, so I got to know him there. But again, you know, we live in different parts of the country, and the artistic highways are quite constrained.
And how do we fix that, aside from more money?
Brooks, how do we fix so much? I mean, jeepers, that's a whole other thing. I mean,
you have 10 minutes. Go ahead.
I just feel like we're standing, when you go walking along the beach and you get like a little ledge of sand and you see how the cracks are forming and then the sand's about to cave in. And so I just feel like, geez, we those cracks are forming and the sand is caving, man. How do we fix all these things? I don't know.
Well, I mean, I ask this question of people in your line of work, quote unquote, often. Last week I asked somebody who was a principal of a high school. I said, okay, the minister of basic education calls you and says, you're the czar of education, now go fix things. What do you do? And she looked at me and she said, whoa, okay, well, here's my list. But in your circumstances, how do we, aside from finding more money at a time when there is virtually no more money available to be found outside of squeezing something else back, how do we fix it?
I think we fix it by developing a real love and appreciation for the arts in young people, in children, because I think that's the future. That's where the future is. You know, there used to be programs. I don't even know if they exist anymore. You know, the National Arts Festival schools program, you know, they had these festivals around the country. Arts education, for me, that's how you fix it. It's a generational thing. It's developing that real appreciation for complexity of thinking, for seeing things through, prisms and lenses that aren't defined by our cell phones and our televisions. It's working with children. It's working with young people.
I mean, the trend was downward already, but then when the COVID interregnum came along, the two and a half years of virtually no things like that, there are people who said people simply got out of the habit of getting out of their houses and going to see live theater or a concert of whatever type. People just didn't do it anymore. They'd prefer to commune with their handheld electronic device.
Well, exactly. And I'm also guilty of that, you know, it becomes a new pattern. And it also becomes difficult because there's less, I mean, it seems to me, and this is talking from hearsay a little bit, but you know, that sponsors who had been sponsoring events for 3 years, they didn't have to give that money up anymore because the events didn't run anymore. And so when the events were launched again, those sponsors had already channeled the funds elsewhere. And so then the kind of programming that is done, it has to be more commercial because you have to keep things afloat. You have to fill those seats. And so it just starts spinning in its own direction. And so the people that are making the more interesting work they either have to not sell your souls. That's a hard thing to say. You have to compromise more possibly. And there's a kind of dumbing down, I feel, which is rather unfortunate. There's such a tendency to dumb down everywhere, isn't there? Isn't there? It's not uniquely South African. You know, I mean, as you mentioned earlier, I did my master's in Amsterdam, and that was 20 years ago. And it was such a moment. There was so much money in the arts. It was left wing politicians and there was so much interest in feeding diverse, interesting arts. And now, I mean, with the swing towards the right in so many parts of Europe, that has changed. Arts budgets have become much more conservative. People that are doing mainstream stuff that doesn't challenge the status quo are given the money. The directors of festivals are often too scared to program stuff because we're living in times where identity politics is so large on the agenda that the fear of making mistake can get one crucified. You know, it's tricky, tricky times. It's tricky times.
Or you can be on the wrong side of a current political debate internationally, and then you're skewered that way as well.
I mean, you didn't mention my one work, Exhibit A. It started off as Exhibit A, and then it became Exhibit B. We played 23 cities around the world. We did it at the National Arts Festival in 2013 or 2011. I forget now. And that was a look at how black people, brown people had been framed by the thinking of the late 19th century in order to make them appear inferior and therefore justify the policies of legitimize policies of genocide, of land grabbing, of colonization, of enslavement, etc. And I mean, the show did really well until we got to the Edinburgh Festival, where the Guardian ran an article which said the Edinburgh Festival's most controversial show, Exhibit B, The Human Zoo. And then everything hit the fan. You know, we opened at the Barbican a couple of weeks later, and 23,000 people who hadn't seen the show signed a petition to close down the show. The opening night, the theater was stormed, and the police closed the show because they couldn't guarantee the safety of the performers or the audience. And then we opened in Paris a few weeks later and Saint-Denis. And again, there was a huge, they called it a polémique, thing that the theater doors were smashed down. The French refused to close the performance because the French mayor, because she's Agnès Tricourt, because she said it was against the policies of France to censor. And so we had 100 gendarmes, riot police guarding the venue every night just to keep it open. But as a result of that, our four-city tour of Brazil, iteration New York and in Canada were all canceled. And soon after that, I had to close the work. And, you know, it was dealing with that canceling because there's such anger at saying things when, you know, sometimes I'm feeling the frustration in my voice here because it's very frustrating. It's a very difficult time to express things freely these days.
I'm glad you brought that up. I had almost forgotten the enormous fuss that was made out of this. It made the riot over the Rite of Spring 100 plus years ago seem like nothing. God.
Oh, I mean, we had death threats. I've started smoking because I was so intense in Paris. If I had to go to the corner store to get some cigarettes, I had 3 bodyguards walking with me. It was really crazy.
I wish we could keep this going, but unfortunately our time has run out and it's been a great pleasure to talk with you.
I mean, to you. Thank you so much.
It's allowed me to remember all the different textures and the works that you've done that I've had a chance to see. I did not see Exhibit A or B. You should do it again. We should do it here.
Oh, I gotta do that one again.
We have been speaking with Brett Bailey, artist, creative person, breaker of barriers, summoner of barricades, in the arts. It's been a great pleasure to talk with you. This is Brooke Spector at the Deep Dive, and we'll be back again next week with another guest in a different genre. I can't tell you which one yet because we're still sorting that part out, but trust me, it will be as interesting in a different way. And again, Brett, thanks very much for sharing some time with us.
Thanks so much, Brooks. Thanks for your support.